Say so long to summer and celebrate Labor Day with a little help from your friendly neighborhood Albertsons. You'll find great deals on delicious favorites for a fun gathering. Shop in the meat department and pick up juicy USDA choice beef ribeye steaks or roasts, bone in for just $4.99 a pound. And stop by produce and get local premium red or green seedless grapes for only 79 cents a pound. Tastier meat, fresher produce, better celebrations. Albertsons, it's just better.
Blog Talk Radio. Hi, welcome. This is syndicated columnist Amy Elkon with Advice Goddess Radio. Nerd your way to a better life with the best brains in science. Now, I love writing when I have one of those magic days when everything somehow just flows, but I have a tendency to describe my writing process as weeping over a keyboard. Well, lately, I've been describing it that way a lot less, thanks to what I've learned and put into practice from the book featured on tonight's show. And sure, the book has all this math stuff in the title, but really, it's a book on how you can do your work and your creative work more efficiently and ultimately more successfully and satisfyingly. My guest tonight is engineering professor Dr. Barbara Oakley, and her excellent book we'll be discussing is A Mind for Numbers, How to Excel at Math and Science, Even If You Flunked Algebra. Hello, Barb.
Hello, Amy. It's so nice to be here.
I'm so glad you're here. Your book really, I can't even emphasize enough how much it's helped me, especially do dreaded tasks. It's really an amazing book about how not to procrastinate with all these concrete steps. But before we get into the details of your book, you have a fascinating story. You talk about math phobes in your book. You're now a tenured professor of engineering, but this is pretty amazing considering where you started, not exactly acing math and science courses. Tell us about your early school career.
Well, people, if you had known me when I was like 22 years old, you would have thought I belonged to a completely different species. I mean, I was this touchy-feely linguist. I studied language, I loathed math and science, and I was certain I didn't want anything to do that ever in my life. And so I look at this now and I laugh because it's like, how the heck could I? I'm a professor of engineering and I love my job. But it is. I switched. And the book of Mind for Numbers kind of tells people how I switched and how they can open and broaden their own passions as well.
Well, what was wrong with your early math and science classes? Why did you fail?
Well, we moved around all the time. My family, my father was in the military, and so it was, by the time I hit 10th grade, I'd lived in 10 different places. And I remember, I was never some genius with math or something. And then in third grade, we moved from Massachusetts to from Texas to Massachusetts, and suddenly I was a half a year behind in math. And a half a year at that age is like a half a light year. I mean, it's really a big difference. So they're all like whizzing around with multiplication, and I really barely knew what that was. And so I just fell off, and then I was like, I can't do this stuff, and I was sure I couldn't do that stuff, and I was almost obnoxiously certain about it. I mean, I remember being called into the dean of students once because it was in eighth grade. I just didn't pay attention in class because I just thought it was useless, and I didn't understand anything, and by the time they got done with me at the dean of students, they just sort of were like, well, I guess it's just hopeless with her because she's not going to pay attention. So I just kind of flunked my way through elementary, middle, and high school math and science.
So, but then you went to the Army. So tell us more of your story. You were in Germany, and you saw that people who got to do good things, got to do things that were, get them ahead, all knew math and science.
That's right. I enlisted in the Army right out of high school because I didn't have the money at the time to go to college, and they didn't have college loans at that time. So I just thought, well, I want to study a language, so I'll just join the Army because they'll pay for me to do that. And they did. And I loved the language I chose. I chose Russian, and I think I probably would have loved any language that I had chosen to study. And I did well at it, and I went out, and then the Army was like, we don't need someone who actually can speak Russian, so we're going to make you into a signal and communications officer, and you're going to be in charge of all these radio and switchboard systems and so forth. And I was like, say what? Because I didn't understand any of that. I didn't even know what a volt was or what electrical current was. So here suddenly I'm supposed to be in charge of this stuff. But when I got out there, I started realizing, wait a minute, this stuff really does something. It's really interesting, and I have no idea how to understand it, but the people who do seem to be able to solve problems in a really effective way. And you know what? What if I could do that? That might open some career doors for me. So getting out into the real world and seeing what kind of job opportunities were available and what people could do who had certain kind of training really opened my eyes to the fact that, maybe me living in my kind of closed-off world wasn't actually the most effective way to approach having a good career.
So you went to community college. You decided to retrain your brain. I think you told me it was a class maybe in trig, and you learned basically what you lay out in the book, that there are actual very sensible steps to learn math and science and really learn anything in a more efficient way. And this is such an exciting thing because so many people think of math as a mystery, but it really isn't. You say that the brain is designed to do extraordinary mental calculations.
Exactly. And before I even talk about those mental calculations, I just want to step back for a moment. When I learned a language, here's what I didn't understand, but I understand it now because I understand the neuroscience behind it. And that is that when you learn another language, you're actually using many, in fact, just a lot of the same skills you use to learn math and science. And because it's often not taught that way, even though it should be, people find it unnecessarily difficult sometimes to grapple with ideas and learning new concepts in math and science. But actually, the learning is much the same at a fundamental level as learning a language. And we're all wired in some sense to be able, when you catch a ball, for example, you're actually doing incredibly complex mathematical computations. So if your brain can do that, all you need to do is learn a little bit of the lingo to be able to translate your innate knowledge into the kind of knowledge that allows you to look at equations and understand what they mean.
And now, one thing that's very integral in your book is you talk about how neuroscientists have been making advances in understanding these two different networks of brain switches between this highly attentive states and more relaxed resting state networks. And you say we're either in focused mode or diffuse mode. So first explain focused mode thinking.
Well, focused mode, you can kind of think of it like a really tight network, and you get caught in this, your little neural network is like this really tight little thing, and you can focus right in and move around on this little tiny, tightly focused network, and you can solve a problem that's where you're very familiar with it, and going from one step to the next is very close together. It's not one big sort of mental leap for you to do that. But if you're looking at something new that you haven't really examined before, you almost need a very different mode of thinking to look at that. So it's almost as if from an evolutionary perspective, we've come up with two very different perspectives, two modes of thinking. The first is that tight focus mode, and the second is the diffuse mode, what I call the diffuse mode, which is actually a set of many different neural resting states, above and beyond even the default mode network, which everyone is always referring to. So this default mode network, and all the resting states, they're kind of like a more diffuse way of looking at things. The neural net, you can kind of think of it as it's got real big webs in it, and you can easily jump very far. So you can't concentrate to tightly focus and solve some little aspect of a problem, but you can make big intellectual leaps that allow you to start homing in on a solution in a new way. So people often don't realize that we've got these two very different modes of thinking, each of which has important things to do when you're learning something new.
And diffuse mode is basically, I think of it like big picture thinking, where focus mode, I'm intensely reading some study, trying to understand all the stuff in it, trying to take in information. Diffuse mode is my brain sort of hopping off and hopping around and being less serious and resting, but also working while it rests.
Yeah, that last thing you said is really important too. It is working, but you're often not conscious of it working. So diffuse mode thinking, it can occur in places like, let's say you're sitting on a bus and you're just kind of looking out the window and you're not really thinking about anything particular, or you're taking a shower, or you're falling asleep at night, or you're just kind of waking up in the morning, or you're just out for a walk. A lot of times that's when you're doing this kind of diffuse mode thinking, and that actually is an integral part of the mental processing you often need to be doing to learn something new. So when you sit there and say, oh, you know, I should be focusing right now to learn this new thing, sometimes what that's actually doing is blocking you from doing the neural processing you need to figure out something that you may be stuck on. So sometimes when you're sitting down to solve a problem and you're focusing and you get stuck, you need to pull yourself off it and get your attention completely off it, because that's what allows these other diffuse mode networks to kick into gear and start working in the background. So isn't that funny? The thing you most want to do is concentrate on it in order to solve a problem, but the thing you have to do is not do that. Force yourself to stop it. And I just love it. It's so counterintuitive but cool.
Yeah, it's so important to go back and forth like that. And Greg, my producer, he was the researcher for crime novelist Elmore Leonard for 33 years, and he asked a question over Skype, and this is something that I relate to. He said, why do people have good thinking in the shower? Like Dutch, that's Elmore, had his best ideas in the shower. And I also, when I'm at the end in my column process, I paste it up on the wall and take a shower because I can kind of read it differently in there. And I also have ideas that come in the shower. It is after that focused mode of thinking that those just somehow pop up.
It's true. It's just that when you're in the shower, you can't be concentrating on something unless you've got some particular love of soap or something like that that you like to focus on. There's nothing to do in there. So your mind has to kind of cast around and let go. And I think it gets used to doing that, and so it actually makes it easier. It's like the shower is someplace where you let go and you get used to doing that. And so then when you step in there, it just kicks into that gear much more easily. One creativity expert has said that the bed, the bath, and the bus, those are the most common places for these kinds of creative insights, and likewise, they're the most common places for this kind of diffuse mode thinking to kind of kick in.
I think of this diffuse mode thinking as background thinking, and from reading your book, I have really learned something. I have my deadline is Monday and Tuesday, and Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday I'm supposed to write, but Wednesday I'm always a little tired. What I've learned is to start Wednesday and to do something, to get some writing done, because then my brain is processing in the background, and I find that Thursday I'm much better at writing on Thursday if I've just done that sort of start your brain, get that stuff seated in there, and then when I'm sleeping or doing whatever, my brain, the Bed Bath and what is it, Bed Bath and Beyond, Bed Bath or the bus, I don't take the bus, but doing something, walking the dog, these things come to you. And you talk about how Salvador Dali and Thomas Edison used to do this with naps, to switch to diffuse mode thinking. So you can't just be a total workhorse all the time.
Oh, absolutely. I have to tell the story about how, well, like what Salvador Dali, the famous surrealist painter, used to do. He'd sit there and he'd have keys in his hand, and then he'd kind of relax, and he'd relax his thinking, and he'd have his hand over the floor so the keys would be dangling there. And when he'd relax so much that the keys would fall from his hand, they'd fall off, and the clatter would wake him up, because that meant he was just falling asleep. And he would kind of spring out of this diffuse mode, totally relaxed thinking. And during that time, his brain had been able to make these new connections kind of randomly. And he could take these new random connections, bring them back into the focus mode, and then do more creative work with them. So that's the perfect example of how work, creative work and even regular work, often involves this idea of relaxing, getting new ideas, putting them together, and then bringing them back into the focus mode to work. But it wasn't just Salvador Dali. Thomas Edison, the famous inventor, used to do almost exactly the same thing. He'd sit with ball bearings in his hands. So this kind of accessing of different modes of thinking from a neuroscientific perspective is something that everybody can do in very different fields. So, and it's not just super incredibly creative people. I mean, it's ordinary people like you and me and anybody. You always have new problems or ideas or issues that you are grappling with, and these approaches help you do that.
Right, and even if you're just coming up, not just, but you're coming up with an advertising plan for someone, all of these things we do in business, there's so much creativity involved, and it's so helpful. And one thing I learned from this, from reading about the focused versus diffused mode, that intense focus and then this backing off and letting your brain work in the background, we'll talk later about working with a timer. I work with a timer on an hour. You work with a bit shorter timer. But I've learned to break at the half-hour mark and go do something. Believe me, cleaning my house, the last thing I want to do, unless it's a way to procrastinate. But I'll pick up 25 things. I do this. My house is much cleaner now, thanks to you. And I live in a house that looks gently, I describe my decorating style as gently ransacked. But that seems to help me when I come back to the computer for the second half hour to have solved some things that I wouldn't have if I were just intensely, nervously continuing to work.
Isn't that funny?
Yeah, it really is amazing. So I wanted to say that just as my example from real life, so people would understand the practical ways that this works, because it's neuroscience, and that sounds kind of complicated, but it's really not. It's work for half an hour, take a break for 10 minutes, do something else, come back, and try to do something. My feeling is that, you can go fool around on the internet, but I try to do something stupid. And by stupid, I mean something that takes no intellectual energy, that's not taking my brain off somewhere else. You know, put away a bunch of stuff, dust something. Believe me, there's a lot in need of dusting here. And that seems to get rid of, what we'll talk about next, which are stumbling blocks. And let's talk about that. The Einstellung effect. Tell us what that is.
Well, Einstellung is that you have a previous thought in mind and you think that's the answer. And what that does is it actually blocks your ability to see the real answer, because you think you've already got it. And this phenomenon was first discovered with chess players. They found that if chess players were prompted to think of the board in a certain way – that they would be unable to see the solution. But if they weren't prompted to think in that first way, they could see the solution quite easily. So it was like that first solution blocked their ability to see other solutions. And I see that all the time. I mean, I think it's a little bit of the source of that old saying that science progresses funeral by funeral. and part of that is you get so good at what you know that when something new is presented to you, it's really difficult to kind of climb out of that neural network that you've built so well and build a new neural network because the one that you had is so comfortable and so well ingrained. So I think we all need to be aware of that, and it can be very helpful to be aware of that.
Well, when we come back, I want you to tell us how you get out of this Einstellung effect, and I want to say I think it translates as installation, and you think of it as installing a roadblock. So we're going to talk about removing a roadblock, but first, this is Amy Elkon's Advice Goddess Radio, Nerd Your Way to a Better Life with the Best Brains in Science. My guest tonight is Dr. Barbara Oakley, and her excellent book we're discussing is A Mind for Numbers, How to Excel at Math and Science, Even if You Flunked Algebra. But even if you have zero interest in math and science, stick with us, because this book is really about how to live and work as the optimum you, to be as productive as possible with as little grief and procrastination as possible, and maybe even some really good feelings. So, okay, how do we get rid of, we're attached to this first thought we have, we think it's the greatest thing. How do we detach from that and open up and think about consider other ideas?
Well, it depends on the situation, of course. But let's say that you're trying to solve a math problem or you're trying to figure out some kind of issue related to your plumbing, or you're trying to figure out how you should plot your next novel, or you're just trying to deal with some office politics at work. So you have an idea in mind, oh, this is how I'm going to handle this. And you might be thinking about it, but after a while, you begin to see, wait a minute, there's a problem here. This is not really working. Hopefully you're astute enough to see that there can be a problem, because some folks, they suffer from illusions of competence in learning, and they can't get to the step where they realize that, hey, there's a problem here. But I think most people, if they look perceptively at the world, they can, well, except for me, I think I run into roadblocks all the time, but you can see when you run into a roadblock like this. And I think the tip-off is frustration. There's something that's not working right. So when this frustration happens, that is a time for you to retool and be a little bit more open to the diffuse modes, which is your subconscious attempting to grapple with that problem, with whatever problem it is. And be a little bit more open to that. And also be open to, and this is kind of funny, but be open to analogies and metaphors that your mind might be sending you as signals to try and look at the problem in a new way. Often, metaphor and analogy are brilliant tools for helping us see new ways to look at things. For example, they found that when they're trying to get students to understand what's a good way for radiation to attack tumors, that a very effective way to get them to understand how to do that is to first tell them about how attacking a fortress in the old days used to work really well if you sent troops in from sort of every direction. And if you tell them that story and then you present them with the problem of how do you attack this tumor, they easily come up with the idea, oh, we should attack this tumor with radiation that comes from many directions at once. But if you don't tell them that story, they really just don't have any idea how to do it. So these stories and metaphors and new images can often signal to us new ways of tackling problems, everywhere from scientific problems to problems with relationships. And we want to keep ourselves open to those metaphors and those stories so that we can try to approach things in new ways.
Now, I write a science-based column about relationships, but it's also humor, and so play is a big part of my work. And I find that this, you know, not being so panic-stricken about being focused, of course I focus and I work very hard, but to back off, to play, you know, and to make play, you know, part of thinking about things, that really helps to do what you're talking about, just because I have to think of funny things to say and it's fun. And also, one other thing that I use to guard against just thinking that my first idea is genius is that instead of illusions of competence, I have worries of incompetence. And I find that not being arrogant about my abilities, to always worry, did I really think this out? I mean, if you're always thinking like that, not in a sort of low self-esteem, a horrible, poor me way, but just to always look at that I think that allows you to go a little further. And really one thing to it is to take that first idea and think, oh, okay, let's see if that's really the thing, you know, to avoid that Einstellung effect, that the roadblocking.
Yes, and I think that ability to second-guess yourself and say, you know, am I really that good there? Is this really right? I think that can be a problem sometimes, that second-guessing, because you go around, people are like, oh, you're great, and you're sitting there inside going, well, really? Am I really that great? I don't think so. But it actually, I think it's a good thing to do in many cases, because then you don't put your own thinking on a pedestal, which is the first way to get to Einstellung. Oh, I had that thought, and so it's really brilliant. In fact, there's a great story that, let's see, who was it? Hans, I think it was Bethe. Oh, gosh. There was a great physicist, and he used to work with Feynman. And what had happened was he was so brilliant, this one physicist, that nobody would ever argue with him or say he was wrong. And so what that meant was he just couldn't think creatively, because everybody was always like, oh, whatever ideas you have are always the best. And so then it turns out that Feynman was the only one who would sit there and say, oh, you know, I think what you're thinking is full of baloney. And so he would actually be able to come up with new ideas in quantum physics just as a result of the fact that Feynman would sit there and put him in his place and kind of put him down a little bit.
That feedback is so essential. I never understand how people go around, especially people who have really big jobs, without having that. I pay an assistant. He works for me part-time. His job is to tell him I'm an idiot. Tell me I'm an idiot. I'm not clear, and I'm not funny. And this is how I get clearer and smarter and funnier. And if you don't have an ego that allows that, you're really missing out, because that kind of criticism, not just from anybody, but from somebody whose mind and judgment you respect, they may not always be, you may not always agree with them, but it can really provide you with an important sounding board. And I encourage people, if you can afford it, pay somebody to tell you you suck.
It is such an important thing to do. I mean, it's absolutely critical to be able to take criticism and actually solicit criticism. And I think one of the reasons if the book Mind for Numbers is any good at all, it's really because I got such wonderful criticism from fantastic, fantastic people, and that helped a lot to help just make it into the good book that I think it is. I mean, we're talking hundreds and hundreds of top professors.
Right,
so
I was just trying to bring that out.
Kind of cool.
So that and students, you had students tell you, does this work for you? And I think that this is how one of the really great sections of your book, it's so funny that it's called A Mind for Numbers, How to Excel at Math and Science, Even If You Flunked Algebra. And this book really has the best advice on preventing procrastination. And that's what we're going to go to next. So stick with us. I want you to start with the story about arsenic, because this relates to procrastination. So tell us about how arsenic and procrastination relate.
Well, okay. So there was they had a big scientific meeting in the late 1800s, and they got these two guys up on the stage, and they gave them both lethal doses of arsenic. And then the next day, they brought these guys back, and they were smiling, they were happy, they were really healthy. And, I mean, you have to sit there and go, what the heck? How could these people eat arsenic and still look healthy? Well, as it turns out, what these people, what they would do in this one strange little area of Austria is they would take arsenic, tiny amounts of it, and they'd increase the amounts they'd take. And it would make them look healthy, although it was actually setting them up for all sorts of cancer and really bad stuff. But because they took just small amounts of it, they looked okay. And then they got used to it, so they could actually take lethal doses, even though it was actually leading them to an early death. Procrastination is so much like that. It's like this tiny little thing where you take one little dose of it and you go, you know, that didn't hurt. You know, I can do that again. It felt good when I did that. And people don't understand that the reason that procrastination often happens, it seems, is you look at something or you think about something you don't want to do, and guess what? The areas of your brain process pain activate. So when you look at some accounting that you didn't want to do, like your check balancing or something like that, you look at that, and actually areas of your brain that are related to pain light up. So what do you do? There's two ways you can go through it. You can either just kind of work through the pain, so you can actually sit down, start doing it, and within a little bit, that pain will disappear. But there's another, much quicker way to get rid of that pain, and that's just to turn your attention to something else. And that's what people will often do. When they're procrastinating, they're like, you know, I don't want to do this. So, hey, wait a minute, I should be doing this instead. And it may be web surfing or whatever. And by switching your attention, you immediately remove the pain. But it's like a little hit of drugs, right? Because it made things better temporarily. But in the long run, all these temporary little feeling better can add up to something that actually is harmful for you. You procrastinate about a lot of things in life, and it adds up. And particularly in learning, procrastination is a huge issue, and it's something you want to step back from because it takes time to build neural structures when you're trying to figure out something new, and you just can't do that by last-minute cramming. You do poor learning that way.
Yeah, I want to quote you on that. You say, when you procrastinate, you are leaving yourself only enough time to do superficial focus mode learning. And remember, you have to go back and forth between the between the focus mode and then that diffuse mode that backs off and processes it. And that's so important to give yourself. That's why I do these little bits of work every day, because my brain then is working in the background. Instead of when I procrastinate, if I do everything Thursday afternoon at 5 and then work with my assistant in the morning on Friday, I haven't processed stuff enough to actually produce the sort of smart thinking that I want in my work.
Bingo. The thing that I like about this approach of avoiding procrastination, but only avoiding it by doing little bits in every day, not like doing some massive, trying to catch up on everything or something, but just working on some project, for example, a little bit per day. And what that does is it helps you live a guilt-free life. I mean, imagine this. You're working away on something, and then you feel really tired and you can't figure out how to do it. Well, guess what? If you're not procrastinating, you can stop at that point, and you don't need to feel guilty about it. So I just love that. It's so freeing in a lot of ways to just start earlier and just do things bit by bit.
Yeah, I think that that's really very important. And a thing that you write about, you say, and you sort of alluded to this before, that discomfort is a big part of this, that we procrastinate about things that make us feel uncomfortable. And you talk about medical imaging studies that they show that math phobes, for example, avoid math because thinking about it seems to hurt. The pain centers of their brains light up. But what you say that's very important is that it's the anticipation that was painful, and that when they actually did the math, the pain disappeared. And this is what I find. I did all this stuff that I dread this week because of your book, and using a timer, not just for my work but for other things, and we will get to that. So I put on a timer. I hate answering boring email, not email from my friends, which is fun and interesting, but those things you have to answer. Somebody needs something. You have to tell them no. You have to do this and that and the other thing. So I just turned it on for half an hour instead of just thinking I have to answer that one person's email. And I probably worked for 45 minutes and cleared out my email box of a lot of stuff. And you just feel so good about yourself after you engage in that. So then you don't feel you're less compelled to procrastinate the next time.
That's exactly right. And you get kind of closer to being caught up, and that's somehow less painful. So when you do think about working on it again, it's like, oh, well, hey, I'm closer to being caught up there, and it just doesn't seem as bad. Now, I will mention that, let's say I'm working on a new research area or a new paper or something like that. Sometimes when I'm first starting, it can actually take me a few days, maybe even a week of Pomodoros or something like that. And I'm like, oh, gosh, I don't want to do that.
Oh, wait, Barbara, I have to stop you because you said Pomodoros. Stop and just tell people what a Pomodoro is.
A Pomodoro, now that's it's Italian for tomato. And this was a technique invented by the Italian Francesco Cirillo in the 1980s. And all this technique consists of is you set a timer for something like 25 minutes, and then you put away everything that might sort of put an alarm up or email or your cell phone or whatever, any kind of sound or visual thing that might be distracting. Put that away, set your timer for 25 minutes, and then go. So you focus for 25 minutes. And it's sort of like almost like a little competition. You know, if you were racing, if you were running in a race, you would try to make yourself run as fast as you can. Well, when you're concentrating on a Pomodoro, in a little bit of a sense, you're trying to do that same sort of intent-focused sort of sense of what you're doing as you are when you're competing in a race. And it's not that you're trying to make yourself think faster. You're just trying to say, I want to focus as intently as I can on this without being distracted. Now, occasionally, my thoughts will come up like this. Okay, I'm trying to focus and pay attention, but I'm thinking about focusing and paying attention, so I'm not really focusing and paying attention. Well, when I catch myself doing that, I just kind of put it out of my mind, you know, push it back, and then try and go right back to thinking about what I'm doing. So that's what you do for 25 minutes. But here's the most important thing of all with this technique is when you're done, you have to reward yourself with something, like something relaxing and kind of nice. 5-10 minutes of, I don't know, surfing the net or get yourself a latte, whatever floats your boat. But what you're actually doing by alternating these two different activities is you're enhancing your ability to work in focused mode, and then you're practicing your ability to use the diffuse mode and relax. So it's like an intense 25-minute workout or whatever time frame you choose, and then it's followed by this kind of nice relaxation, and it works out beautifully, and you actually rewire your mind with these gradually over time to enjoy both the focusing and the relaxing.
Now, and this gets you into something called flow, which Mihai Csikszentmihalyi, this was his notion, and it's when you forget yourself, you get so into the work, it's this wonderful state, and that's something you can get into by turning on the timer, and believe me, I do not want to turn on the timer, but you really do have to, as you said before, just start, and then when the distraction arises that comes up, you want to do something else, inevitably that will happen. You have to train yourself to ignore it. So I just have a rule that when I turn on the timer, I train my friends not to call me at home. You know, I don't get on the internet unless I have to look something up related to work. You have to stick to those rules because it starts to feel good. You start to ingrain good habits instead of bad habits.
Exactly right. And it works so well. That 20, I can't tell you how many times I've sat there and I'm like, you know, I don't want to do this. I don't want to do whatever it is. And I'll sit there and set the timer, and I'll kind of get started. And after 10, 15, 20 minutes, I'm like, this is just too weird. Because I really didn't. I was like, I'm going to make myself do one 25-minute stint, and then I was going to, that was it. But actually, you know, this isn't so bad. Maybe I'll kind of keep working on this. It happens so often. So these kinds of little mental tools or tricks are so invaluable in just allowing you to live a life that's less guilty and more enjoyable, because it keeps you up on things at the same time that it allows for you to relax as well.
When we come back, we will talk a little bit about habits. But first, this is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio. My guest tonight is Dr. Barbara Oakley. Her excellent book we're discussing is A Mind for Numbers, How to Excel at Math and Science, Even If You Flunked Algebra. And really, I want to tell you, those of you who don't really care about putting two and two together, rubbing two and two together, that this is so much about learning how to learn, learning how to be efficient, how not to procrastinate. This is such a valuable book. It's changed my life already. And beyond that, I just wanted to say, to welcome all the new followers to my show, and all of those of you, thank you, who have been with me since the beginning. Greg and I have now been doing this show for three years now, almost 3 years. We just were finalists for an LA Press Club Award with all the other finalists, the other four were from KCRW, which is the NPR powerhouse in LA, so I love that. And stick with us for weeks to come to hear from the luminaries of behavioral science. And Barb, I love that about you. Here you are, you're an engineering professor, and I came to your class once at Oakland University, and you made it so fascinating telling people how their refrigerator runs. You can tell us how any appliance works, but yet you've gone into writing about and thinking about psychology, and I think that that's something really important. You get into this too, you know, about coming at things from a different angle, and really I think that that stepping back, like you said, with metaphor, that that's really important. So that must help you in your work, being an engineer who is looking at psychology.
Oh, I think it really does. Sometimes I think that because I learned engineering and I learned math and science as an adult, that it's like learning a second language as an adult. I might speak it with an accent, but I have an understanding of how things are put together that people who learn it more naturally, they don't see these kinds of connections because it was all just right there to begin with. I mean, sometimes it's try asking a native speaker of English who doesn't speak another language some of the nuances of the English language, and it's really difficult for them to parse it. They don't have an understanding of the grammar or the syntax, except only in an intuitive fashion. But it actually can be very helpful to look at things from a different perspective. And I think the work of Thomas Kuhn in Structures of Scientific Revolution, he was a wonderful philosopher and historian of science, Thomas Kuhn. And one of the things that he discovered was that when people make really new observations that can actually open new doors for people in how to look at things, often those people were originally not trained in that field. Sometimes they were either sometimes they're very young people, so they don't have Einstellung, they don't have the built-in neural infrastructure that blocks their thinking, but sometimes they come at it from other disciplines, and that allows them to look at things with a fresh perspective. And I think that's what I do with my work. I mean, I never, even with my classes, I never get up and say, well, of course, it's intuitively obvious that whatever, you know, Bayes' theorem, whatever I'm deriving or doing, I never say it's intuitively obvious. And that helps, I think, sometimes to look at things in a fresh way.
I think that's good advice, too, for people listening, that even if you are very well trained in what you happen to do, you're directly trained in that, to come at things from a different perspective, to look at how, for example, a baker would think of things. And in fact, Barb, from knowing you, I am influenced by you talk about trade-offs, that engineering is, to a great extent, about trade-offs. You know, do you make the bridge out of this steel that costs $5 million? Or do you make it out of this steel, and how much, what percent of risk do we have that the bridge will collapse? And so to look at things in psychology that way is very important. And so maybe if you're stuck, this idea of coming at things, even if you're trained directly in something, pretend that you're a baker, pretend that you're a train conductor. How would you solve the problem? Because sometimes, like you said with Feynman, the person who's not as expert, who comes at things a little differently, can give you some solutions or at least some feedback, like my assistant gives me.
I think you're exactly right. It's interesting. We're teaching this. My colleague, Dr. Terence Sinofsky, he's the Francis Crick Professor at the Salk Institute, and I are teaching a very large course. We've got 120,000 people now, and they're wonderful. You should see the discussions on the discussion forums.
I just have to stop you for a second, Barb. I want to tell people, no, there is not an auditorium now in a college that fits 120,000 people. This is a MOOC. I love that term because Greg likes The Godfather. That's a derogatory term in there, but it's not spelled the same way. This is a massive open online course, and this is free. It's called Learning How to Learn for Coursera. So you already got 120,000 plus students signed up for it, which is pretty unbelievable. So tell us, because not everybody knows about this, these online courses about MOOCs and your MOOC.
Well, just wrapping up our previous thoughts and bringing them into this, it's I look at the insights from the people who are taking this course, and they have brilliant questions and brilliant ideas and comments, and I'm like, wow. I mean, if only we could put this in a bottle. There's so many new approaches and actually fundamentally important questions being raised that it's just really cool to see. But what I love about the new technology available that allows us to learn online is I'll let you in on sort of my own guilty little secret. I am horrible in sitting in a class and trying to learn something when somebody's giving a lecture. I just, all I do, I usually get lost after about 15 minutes, and then I'm just serving as a stenographer. I just sit there and kind of copy the notes down, but I actually had to go off by myself and then make sense of it. What I love about online learning is I don't have that distraction of other people moving around, stuff going on in the room, and if I lose the train of thought of what that instructor is saying, I can stop it and take it back and pick it up again. It's wonderful.
I love that.
Yeah,
it would be great if real life would be like that. You know, if you could, you're talking to someone and they're saying something, you've forgotten the meaning of the word, you could just put them on pause, you know, get out your phone, look it up in your dictionary so you wouldn't have to say, well, I don't know that word. That seems like a word everybody should know. So
yeah.
That's really great. I want to come back and we'll talk more about your MOOC, but anyone who wants to sign up for it, you can go to, this is a free Coursera course, Learning How to Learn. Go to barbaraoakley.com, right at the bottom of that page. It's in bold. It'll take you there. But we got derailed from habit and procrastination, and understanding procrastination takes understanding habit. And you talk about what habit is. It basically describes when our brain launches into this pre-programmed mode. So, you know, we're just doing something we did before, And you talk about how it's an energy saver for us because we don't have to think about something. We just do what worked for us before. And by what worked, we may have gotten rewards for doing bad things, like we're surfing the net. So that feels good. So, but that's not a good thing for us to do when we're supposed to be working.
Exactly right. And a lot of times what happens with procrastination, for example, is we will have a habitual response to a small cue. For example, you can be working away, and when somebody, you hear a little text message, you look up and you interrupt what you're doing to look at what's going on there. It's almost like this Pavlovian dog response. You hear the sound and ding, you got to go look. So sometimes by just changing that cue, you can avoid your response and help it so that you don't procrastinate without using a bunch of willpower. And that's really the key. You want to be totally lazy in how you avoid procrastination. You don't want to be sitting there gutting things out and being, hey, I'm going to be Superman here, and I'm going to work all day and work all night, and that's what it's going to take. No, you want to use these little mental tricks that allow you to avoid using focused willpower and concentration, because that's very high metabolism. It costs a lot, and you only have so much willpower. So if you can set things up so that you avoid these little cues that cause you to do things that you really don't want to be doing, that can be a very helpful approach.
Or actually that you really want to be doing. You want to be, you know, texting somebody about your weekend. And so you give these examples, and some of this is called pre-commitment. It's a way to stop yourself from what you know you will be doing. This is from behavioral economics, that you will do that will sort of screw you up. And you give the example, leave your smartphone in the car when going to class. I would turn mine off and put it in a box if that were a problem to me, but I've trained everyone in my life never to phone me. Or text me. So that's very helpful. And my boyfriend, I have poor Greg. He's not supposed to call me. This sounds terrible. But when I'm writing in the morning, that's my intense writing time. I've asked him to please email me, unless of course it's an emergency. You know, then I want to know because I have ADHD. I know that sounds really trendy, but I've had it for years. I take drugs. It helps me. And if I get in this focused state, it's this beautiful thing. And then the phone rings, I'm out of it. So it's really important I maintain that. So you set up these things, like you say, leave the smartphone in the car. Talk to the person. There's somebody who always talks to you when you're doing something. Tell them, look, my writing means really a lot to me. I'm going to write from 6 to 8 in the morning. Please, while I'm doing that, I love you, but don't talk to me. You know, so you set these things up, and this allows you to not do what you want to do, which is anything but work.
Oh, yes, exactly. You know, one trick I use is I have these honking big earmuffs, and if I really have to be focusing on something, and it's difficult for me to do it, I put these earphones on. And they're like really big, and they kind of crunch my head just a little bit. And they do two things. For one thing, it blocks out sound, which really does help reduce distractions when you're critically trying to concentrate. But the other thing it does is it signals my family. It's like, hey, wait a minute, she's got those big earphones on. Let's leave her alone for a while. And that works most of the time, but other times it doesn't. But I look so funny because I'm sitting there and I look like Mickey Mouse with these big ears on. But hey, it works. And they don't laugh too much at me. So, you know, what can I say?
Right. It's very important. I do that too. I have a new book out, Good Manners for Nice People Who Sometimes Say Fuck. And because I swear I'm a modern manners person, I'm not a prissy manners person. Can't tell you where to put the fork, except don't poke someone in the eye with it. But I call these asshole canceling headphones. My boyfriend got me them. They're Bose. Those are $300. And let me tell you, they are worth every cent. You know, it really blocks out a lot of the annoyance of life. And so I wear those when I'm writing, especially if there's noise or something, because believe me, you want any excuse you can have to not do your work. And you'll be like a jailhouse lawyer looking for those. And by the way, speaking of jail, Greg says Mook is from Mean Streets. And yes, I said it is a racist term, but that's always what I think of when I see the online massive open online course. I think of actually Mean Streets, which Greg, he watches all those movies. But back to something that you mentioned before. This is very, very important. The notion of not using willpower, and you write about this, the work of Roy Baumeister, he talks about how he's a researcher in psychology, how the brain is expensive, and it uses tons of energy when we have to bring up our willpower. And this is what is so important about what you're saying. You're saying, look, come up with these habits. These habits are things, it's like a monkey. Just like, turn on your timer and get to work. This is what I do. This is what I do. And you bring this up, get started. You have to get started. And so when I say this is what I do, what I mean by that is that there's no negotiation. There's no, oh, well, I could later, or I could this or that or the other thing. It's turn on the timer and work. And then when the timer dings after an hour, or I've been doing this half hour break, then I can go do something else, but then I have to start again. And you have to really be like that with yourself, because that way you get the work done, you feel good, and the energy to have willpower is so, so great. You know, it's just, as you say, the brain needs to, you need to, like, use the willpower as little as possible.
Absolutely. And another thing is, when you're trying to do some of these things, you don't want to think, oh, my goodness, today I'm going to be the most totally effective person in the world. I'm just going to change everything about my life. No, you want to do one Pomodoro. Do one tiny successful thing, and then, like, triumph in it. I mean, just enjoy the heck out of the fact that you did one 25-minute stint of something you didn't want to do. And by golly, it just is so effective in just starting to learn to celebrate your small successes and make sure they're just a few small successes. Don't try and overwrite everything in your life. And it works. Just to gradually make changes.
I want to use the wonderful words you use to describe this. You say a process focus, not a product focus. That you focus on the process, that you work for 25 minutes or an hour, whatever it is you set your timer for. And I find this, believe me, when I'm first starting my column, I feel like an idiot. I feel worried. I think, how am I ever going to do this? I'm not smart enough. I don't have any humor for this. You know, it's going to suck. They'll all know I'll be fired next week from every single paper I run in. And doing this thing that you said, focusing on the process, just write. All you have to do to be successful is you have to write and think for half an hour or whatever amount of time it is. That is so, so important.
Oh, that's – I'm so glad you brought this up, because that's key. You never want to sit down and think, you know, in these 25 minutes, I am going to get this major task done. You never want to think about the task. You just want to think about doing your best to focus. That's all. And that gets you into the flow so that you actually begin enjoying the work a lot more. So avoid thinking of finishing a task, because that is brutal. Just think about getting into the process, the flow.
When we come back, we're going to talk about frogs, but I want to let you know who you've been hearing. My guest tonight is Dr. Barbara Oakley. Her excellent book we're discussing is A Mind for Numbers, How to Excel at Math and Science, Even If You Flunked Algebra. And do not be mistaken, this book, if you wanted to skip the math and science stuff, sorry, Barb, you can do that, because there is such wonderful stuff in this book about how not to procrastinate, how to be productive. And I want to get to one of those things. You have this wonderful line from a writing coach, Daphne Gray Grant: eat your frogs first thing in the morning. What does that mean?
It means when you get up and you start working away, do the task that you like the least most, and just do it for a little bit. You don't have to, like, work for 8 hours on some big, long task that you didn't want to do, but just do some little bit of some task you really don't want to do, but that's important for you to be doing. And by doing that kind of first off, it actually frees the rest of your day. You're feeling like, hey, you know, whatever else I do, I got that thing done. And it just is so, it's shocking. As time goes by, if you use this technique, and just do like 20, 25 minutes a day of the really the thing, the icky thing you didn't want to do first thing in the morning, all of a sudden your life starts lightening up. All these things that you've been meaning to do for years start getting knocked off, and it's a wonderful feeling.
Yeah, and what's really important on that, too, we were talking about the work of Roy Baumeister and how the brain is expensive energy-wise, uses a lot of energy. Research shows that in the morning you seem to have a lot more energy than you do later in the day. So you're using your best energy to tackle your toughest problems, which is going to make you feel better because you're more likely to solve them then.
Oh, absolutely. I work on my toughest, most important things in the morning. And I realize that different people operate differently and have different times work for them. But for me, it's absolutely the key is work on really hard creative or whatever stuff first off, and then do the more mundane routine kinds of things later in the day, because by then I my willpower is starting to kind of slip a little bit, and it's a little harder for me to focus intently and think about things that are really hard to think about.
Well, this is great advice. I have loved talking with you, Dr. Barbara Oakley. Dr. Oakley's excellent book we've been discussing, very helpful, A Mind for Numbers, How to Excel at Math and Science, Even If You Flunked Algebra. And this is a book, even if you don't care at all about math and science, this book will help you be better at being you and working as you. So thank you so much, Barb, for being with us tonight.
Oh, thank you, Amy. It's always a pleasure.
Any Napa guy knows, and science proves, the best
we are in.